You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, powered by Interstate Batteries. From your truck to your trail camera, Interstate Batteries has you covered. Visit your local Interstate Battery store today or online at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Thanks for joining us right here on Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network. This is an Atlanta Legacy Habitat Focus podcast. I'm your host, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye.
And you have been saying this and probably thinking it a long time, and I know we've had this comment a few times of, well, it may work in Missouri, but up here in the North Country,
the
winters are tough, and you can't manage like you can in the South. So,
Or Midwest.
Or East. And we all say it at some point is, well, everything is different. And it certainly is. You can't manage the same way in certain parts of the country. So what works in Georgia may not work in Missouri. What works in Missouri may not work in Delaware. And all the way down the line. So, but I guess the key principles of that, of managing and trying to, as we talk about so much of managing in nature's image and trying to improve the habitat of the historical site, what was native to that area, because that's when that land was most productive. And so wherever we go, the thing is always, how do we get this more productive, as in what was here across the native landscape? So that is even the case for the Northwoods. And so that was the Southern guy trying to do his best Northern accent.
Sorry, but I think that you gave that one away.
I'm not too upset about it. I'll never
claim to be a Northerner.
I'm nothing against them, but I would never be able to. What I was going to say was I'll never be able to pass as a Northerner.
Yeah.
There's just too much twang in this voice. So anyway, the Land and Legacy boys went north, and we headed up to Michigan.
Michigan, Southwest Michigan, a couple weeks ago when we did the podcast up there with the guys from Crockery Creek Co-op. But while we were there, we were doing a land management tour, a consultation for one of the members of that co-op. And he has so graciously allowed us to talk about his property on this week's podcast, give a breakdown of what we saw, our recommendations, and that way we can help share insight that we saw there on the property and basically kind of give our take on what to do, what the next steps are for him moving forward on this property. So it's a really neat property. He's done a lot of work and has not lived there for a long time. So it's cool to see someone so active out there working the landscape, trying to improve it, but is a great hunter, busy being a dad and working, but still just that active lifestyle on this property. So this week we're going to break down the old Michigan Deer Woods.
That's right. Going up to the old, put your old hand up, your left hand, and kind of put your fingers together and your thumb out, and we're going to put it right there in the lower left part of the hand in that part of Michigan. That's where we're at, right? I always wanted to do that, go to Michigan and say, now where am I on here? On this old map that I got with me.
You wanted to be like the typical tourist.
That's right.
Now point me, where am I here?
That's right. That's right. Wasn't going to pass as a local anyway, so let's just go full-fledged tourist. So we are headed Southwest Michigan, and we are going to break the property down. But before we do that, we want to remind you that this week's podcast is brought to you by Deer Lab. Now, I don't know if you know what Deer Lab is. Matt, do you know what Deer Lab is?
I'm very familiar with Deer Lab.
Deer Lab is a software system for organizing and learning your trail camera images. Now, you may be wondering, for me, it's always been, okay, what do you mean by that? And I always go back to 10 years ago whenever it was, I have 6 USBs or I have 20 SD cards and I'm trying to put post-its on them and say, oh, that's where I've got that really good card pull from November 5th. It's on this SD card. Deer Lab organizes your images, puts them nice and easy for you to find, break it down for specific hit list, buck, specific location. You can even go down to, I only want to see daylight images. There's a heat map. There's all kinds of wonderful things, so we encourage you to check it out.
And this is the time of year when we really start getting back into that software, because bucks are growing antlers, starting to be showing some unique characteristics, and we're categorizing them. So we're going to be talking more and more about the power of Deer Lab in the next couple weeks as trail cameras are out and we're getting some pictures of bucks in these food plots. So that's
for
an
sure.
exciting time frame.
Two more reminders, or two other things to add here is, if you haven't already, please subscribe to wherever it is you're listening, whether it be on iTunes or Stitcher. And also, please leave us a review. Now, there's been a lot of great reviews. We appreciate it. You guys motivate us to do this at, what time is it now? 9:30 at night. So we'll be doing this till 10:30 or probably 11 o'clock. So that's why we do it. Your reviews help encourage us to continue. Also, there was one other thing I was going to add there, and now my mind
just blanked, huh?
Blanked it. So anyway.
Oh, I have a reminder.
Okay, let's hear it.
Film 3 just got released last week when this gets aired. So last week, go back and make sure if you have not watched film number 3, we call it Spring Revival. Check out that film because it's turkey hunting, food plots, and a simple way for you to do habitat work but put money back in your pocket.
That's right. And I think since we just released it last night, we want to give you another week to check it. So next week, we'll break down that film.
Yes.
And tell you guys exactly what it is we're going to be doing and have done on that place. So anyway, also, that was the third thing I was going to add. If you haven't realized it now, we've started doing podcasts that are releasing also on Sportsman's Nation, typically on a Saturday, that are more hunting-specific podcasts. So, you know, we can talk all day long about habitat and land management, but we can also do it about hunting. So we encourage you to go check that out as well, because it's not going to be a lot of... one comment we get a lot is, you need to take a notepad when you listen to their podcast, because there's a lot of information you need to write down. But also, on the hunting one, it's going to be more focused on hunting strategy that we use successfully. So,
and we don't use notes for that one, so it's off the cuff. It's just a topic. We roll with it, so it's going to be lighthearted, fun, and still informational. So I hope you guys enjoyed those ones.
All right. Crockery Creek property in southwest Michigan.
Yes, 130 acres of primarily timber, but a mix of timber. As we got in there, of course, there's species there that we don't typically see here in the Midwest, familiar with some of them from being back east. But here, there was, okay, let's just name all the oaks that we saw. There's northern red oak, white oak, bur oak. I believe there's chestnut oaks I saw in there. I think there's
pin oak
places. Yep.
I didn't see many on the property. And that's one thing to remind people is, we don't, when we go to a property, we usually do a lot of back research on the native habitat and use some certain things that we can kind of a way to track the native habitat and what's native to that area. So it's not just us showing up and tweaking things and moving stands around. We try to do some homework before we get there, or when we return, to kind of put it all together and understand what's going on there. And this was no different in this case.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And then on top of that, there was elms, maples, hemlock, here on this property, red, scotch pine. So a huge variety of trees. And again, this is mostly timber. So it was cool to see that. It was cool to see how they're all kind of interacting with one another, the stage in which they're growing, and just the overall habitat. So that was cool. A lot of water on this place, really kind of boggy.
And A lot of mosquitoes.
What was neat, though, was them talking about the differences in soils and how you can really walk 5-10 feet and go from sand to clay. And or in
or
other
dig
areas,
dig a few inches deep and hit water.
Yeah. I mean, like,
we weren't
it
far
wild.
From Lake Michigan, so the water table was just right, I think they said 8 inches below the surface.
Yeah.
Or something like that. So you don't build basements there, and
you mound up dirt and then you put a house on that in some instances. But yeah, I think they said they're 20 miles east of the edge of the lake.
Yeah.
So just a cool habitat. There's some swamp there in the center of the property. And the landowner who had owned this property before, our client had tried to drain that swamp and spent hours and hours digging ditches throughout the woods just to try and move water out of it and to Crockery Creek. So it was kind of interesting, some neat features. But anyhow, number one, we're going to go through 10 steps too throughout this podcast of our recommendations, what we saw, what to do here moving forward. So
Lana Legacy, managing in the Northwoods. Yeah. Step number one, which is true for every part of the country, access. That was one thing, one of the biggest improvements to make on this place was tweaking the road system that's already got, I think they said just that 4 miles of road systems on this
130 acres.
So
roads everywhere.
There's roads everywhere. But unfortunately, there's a couple key places where the road, where there is not a road along the boundary. So yes, one of the biggest improvements we can make for the hunting strategy is, and it may not be a road, especially on the southeast part of the farm, it may not be a road that gets traveled like crazy or where you drive your equipment through, but it's at least a trail that you can walk quietly around the property. Correct. To where you can intercept deer travel patterns.
Right. He's got, again, like I said, an incredible road that leads to all the places he already needs to plant. So this is simply an access trail to cleanly move around the property, skirt the edges cleanly from the areas that he needs to, that are basically really sensitive, needs to keep a sanctuary, a secure area. So like I said, there's a couple places marked on the map that those roads and access are not present right now, but are going to definitely help in the future on this property. There's one in the southeast, and then we've got another. Where did you have that labeled at?
Top northwest kind of
northwest
portion.
Yes.
So when you look at the map, you're going to see two number ones, and you need to. And that's basically the areas that we're going to increase the road, or improve the road, or build a road to where he can move around. And basically, as we start to explain this, you're going to hear about the travel patterns of deer, and these roads are going to help him move around and not bump deer.
And that's the other thing, as we're leading off in this property, we're going to constantly go back and refer to it because it's something that is super important. But the amount of deer on this place, it is incredible. There's deer everywhere. We could see it through the browse. We could see it through and from the hunting observations that he shared with us. But this place is overrun with deer, as that's one of our points. We'll talk about that. But there's so many deer on this place, it's hard for him to access. They're bedding throughout the entire property, so he can't get around cleanly. But this step one that you see is going to help in that. And then other points we're talking about will condense deer down as well.
So one is improving the hunting strategy, but also making those roads around the boundaries also builds fire breaks.
No doubt.
So as we improve the habitat and we do some of this other work, fire is going to need to return to this area to where he can keep some of that young forest, early successional habitat within reach of the deer so they can have great food throughout the property outside of the food plot areas.
Yes. Number two, that was a really cool place. It was an old blueberry patch, bog, but it was kind of a lower lying area. But anyhow, I guess the previous landowner had planted blueberries, which grow naturally and wildly up there, but had a blueberry patch. So again, this is an open, cleared spot. And basically, it had gone back to kind of early successional habitat. There were broom sedge in there. There were different types of willows growing in there. There was lots of young maples, young evergreens growing back. And basically, it kind of looked like a clear cut, as we'll talk about in other areas that had happened on the property. But it's something just kind of unique that you could come across or run across in Michigan. I've seen those in on properties in Maine. But it was a blueberry patch. And right now, currently, it was a sanctuary. Deer were bedding in there. It was a bedding area. But as you can see there on the map, if you kind of zoom in, there was a road that walked right past, it led right past this blueberry patch.
That was the main road for the southeast part of the farm.
Exactly. That's why, number one, we've got to create a road along the border, because deer definitely actively bed there, and that became a trouble spot, a bumping and alerting deer as he's moving basically to the northern end along the eastern side as he's trying to hunt. So, cool place. Yes, it's still going to remain a bedding area, but we're going to move our pressure, the hunting pressure, off to the side and allow him to basically skirt around area number two and move on. So, number three, and this is another kind of important thing to note. There's crop fields. And this is another thing that surprised you and I, honestly, is the amount of crop ground in Southwest Michigan. I don't know, I guess I was expecting more dairy farms, but there's a lot
That's
of
crop. That's Wisconsin.
There's a lot of crop ground in this area. To his east, to the properties west and north, is all crop. So currently, he's experiencing, basically, his property is the sanctuary, is the bedroom. They are coming there to bed and spend a lot of time during the day, and then he'll hit his food plots maybe on the way back in or on the way out, but spending a lot of the time working back out to these larger crop fields in the evenings. And then we can see that there on the right side, there's corn. Up to the north was alfalfa and large alfalfa fields. And then to the west, I think, was additional corn and soybean rotation. So, again, highly attractive food sources, but kind of gives you an understanding of, okay, how deer might be moving, how they're utilizing this property currently before a lot of management gets done. So, number four.
Where is number four? That's the hemlocks. So number four is the evergreen situation. Now, this is probably the biggest change or the biggest discussion we have with the difference between managing in the south and managing in the north when we talk about the winters. In the north, obviously, there's times where you have 30 inches of snow on the ground for 30 days or maybe even longer, or you have snow on the ground from November or December to March.
Through
and
March,
so
yeah.
You're like, how? You can't manage the same way. I need my cedars. Well, as we always say, we don't hate eastern red cedar. We hate eastern red cedar monocultures and how they start to crowd out to where you have this very much a almost like a tent or a house without doors or sides. There's nothing growing underneath. Now, you have great protection from the elements above, but there's nothing growing underneath. So a monoculture is definitely a problem. And that goes with the basis of our management is managing in nature's image. And when you look at nature historically, monocultures weren't, I mean, I've racked my brain to try and think of a time. And usually when you see a monoculture in nature, something has happened as far as the natural management, whether that be grazing or the natural disturbance, so fire in a lot of cases, has been removed. So monoculture is present. That's where the eastern red cedar monoculture comes from, lack of fire. And so that is one of the biggest discussions with the north is, well, you need some sort of evergreen. Of course you do. You have severe winters. If you had prairie up there, it'd be really difficult for a large deer population to survive on a prairie in the north woods. And we covered that in a couple podcasts ago about the amount of browse that deer eat, especially
Woody
during
browse.
That time of the year.
Yep.
And so if you have deep snow and food plots or you have turnips or whatever it is growing and it's 6 inches under snow, they're probably going to spend more time browsing on woody species. That's where these young forests and these bedding areas really come in. And so if you have scattered hemlocks, which is what number four area is talking about, is this is a great area of scattered, not too thick. Now, there's a couple spots of really big ones, but they're scattered around to where you still have some undergrowth, early successional habitat growing in that area. And so that's where it's a huge benefit. You have great protection, thermal cover. Now we're using it correctly. Thermal cover from the elements, but you also have the ability to grow young forest to provide woody browse during those cold winter months. So you get food and cover versus a cedar tree monoculture where you only get cover above but no side cover and no food below. That's the biggest difference.
Was that like your drop mic, walk away kind of statement right there?
That was like, I'm sick of it. I'm tired of having that debate. I'm tired of the whole, well, cedar trees are awesome. Yeah, sure they are when they're not taking over. Now you can have options where you get food and cover. Here I go again. It's one of those things I'm so passionate about because it's one of the biggest problems, especially here in the Ozarks, Matt. As you've kind of moved from Virginia to the Ozarks, you see how much the cedar tree, eastern red cedar, is taking over the landscape before our very eyes, and I feel like I'm the only guy ever barking about it.
And it's funny that you talk about it here, and because, yeah, we do have this kind of rockier landscape. I lived in central Virginia, but as I went to school in western Virginia, there's portions that were rockier. Of course, we're in the mountain range over there. But there's issues with cedar. A lot of encroachment in that area. It was one of those things not many people talked about, but a lot of overgrown fields, just straight cedar monocultures, and then a lot of hillsides that could have been burned, that historically would have been burned, no longer, and you have got a lot of cedar encroachment. But right, here in Missouri, man, it's everywhere. And it doesn't take long for someone to look and say, wow, there's a lot of cedar, but without the history of the area, the history of the natural ecosystem, you would think it's normal because they're just so prevalent. But here, we're talking Michigan, we're talking lake effect snow weekly. I mean, that's one thing we certainly ask them, okay, guys, on a given February, each week, how much snow do you think you have on the ground here? And they were talking anywhere from a foot to a foot and a half of snow. That's a lot of snow. We definitely don't see that typically here in Missouri. But in response to that, the deer tend to yard up. That is a common behavior that happens in response to that snow. They get in denser groups, denser herds, larger herds, and they will flock to these areas that have this cover, that has the branching structure that the hemlock has to support more snow on its branches, and that will limit the amount of snow underneath its canopy. So that's why here in this situation is so incredibly important that we as a consultant understand the winters, understand the behavior of deer, but understand the differences between some of the other evergreens that we haven't mentioned yet on the property and the hemlock and what the hemlock can do much better than the other evergreens. And it's,
I think of, you know, when I went out west, remember I was telling you about the sitka trees out there and how mm-hmm. their limbs and the hemlock reminded me of that. You know, the way God made them was, you look at the way their branches are, they are. If I was to say, all right, Matt, hold your arms out, I'm going to stick these big old sandbags on your arms, you wouldn't go out like with your arms straight out like in a T shape. You would put your palms up and let them drape over, and that's the way the limbs of these hemlocks and the sitka trees out west is. They're made to hold a lot of weight, a lot of snow on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so by doing that, there's not as much snow on the ground below them. So
even down to like the needle design, they're very branching. They're longer, they stretch out, so they can support that additional weight that without fail it's going to happen every single year. And talking with the client, it's like, hey, Jason, where do most of the deer during the time frame of deep snow? Where do you find them? Oh, well, they're scattered, you know, over here, and not to our surprise, I guess, in that area, number four, that's where a lot of the hemlocks were. And I think you brought up the point earlier, it's a great point to make, is, you know, these aren't just really dense pockets of hemlock. These are naturally occurring hemlock scattered throughout this timber, which produces a great opportunity for the cover, but then forage in close proximity to that incredible cover during this time of the year.
Yeah.
If this was not present on the landscape, if these hemlocks were not here, honestly, it'd be a rough time for deer on the property during certain portions of the year, extreme winters, extreme cold, deep snow, because there's very few other places that they would be able to seek as good of refuge from those conditions. So extremely important here. If you're facing these conditions, similar conditions, I think of other states like Minnesota, Wisconsin, parts of Ohio get a lot of snow. Northern Ohio, Western PA, yeah, New York, Western New York, all that lake effect snow is just constant. Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Maine, all that.
Evergreens play a huge part in that landscape, and that's where the hemlock has been a fantastic thing on this property and in many parts of the north,
mm-hmm.
as well as other native evergreens, which that goes right into number five, the red pine plantations that have been specifically planted for a harvest later on, but usually with the pine plantation or pine plantings is there's a process in the correct management to where you plant and then in a few years or 5 to 10 years you return and do a thinning, and then you return 5 or 10 more years later and then you do another thinning, and then it turns into almost a savanna type effect where they're scattered around, there's lots of stuff growing in between, and then you make that final harvest, the clear cut, and then you go back and plant again. That hasn't happened here.
Right. And you can clearly see this area, number five. It's very, very dense, but that dense evergreen is not nearly as beneficial as the hemlock that you see kind of scattered around number four. This red pine is a plantation. It has been planted in rows, specific rows, but left unmanaged since then. So as we look up in the canopy of this, one, the structure is not nearly the same. It reminded me, the Virginia boy, of the old Virginia pine, the scrag pine, that just kind of almost is like the Charlie Brown pine tree. Just very ragged, had very few needles. Because of these ones were so densely packed, there was very little cover up top.
They were a classic example of two crowded, sickly trees.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they didn't look healthy, they had a lot of dead tops, and they were just very unhealthy trees, which unhealthy trees is not a good thing. And so a thinning would have been great, or in this case, what we'll probably recommend is a leaving a couple of pockets of them, a couple portions of it, but getting the rest of them cut out and providing more of a clear cut so you get more early successional woody species to provide more food in this on this farm.
Yeah, and just a heck of a lot better cover. And that's the other point that needs to be made in this area, and especially this region that has the deer numbers that it does. And when I say deer numbers that it does, we're talking easy, I would say confidently, 120 deer per square mile, probably.
You said 100 to 120 deer per square mile.
Yeah, like that's a lot of deer. And they're experiencing that when they're hunting. Some camera surveys are supporting that.
Don't give it away. That's number 10.
Oh, I'm not. But in this area, there was so much deer sign in number 5. And I want to make this distinction that, okay, we know that there's a lot of deer sign in here. There's heavy trails. There's deer droppings. We saw deer beds. But that doesn't still mean that it cannot be, should not be improved based on the habitat that was there. And I think there's a lot of places that we might come across deer sign and say, oh, I don't want to change anything. They're already here. Well, maybe it's because there's too many deer. Or maybe it's just that they pass through. They bedded down sometimes. Adam, you were talking about
you see four beds. You see beds
adjacent
in a field.
To a food plot. Yeah.
And you can sometimes look at that and go, why are those deer bedding there? Well, just because you see beds there doesn't mean it's a bedding area. A lot of times you'll stumble across beds where you're like, huh, that's interesting. But it's not like they're going to, if you hunted over a bed like that, you may sit there for 360 days before you ever even see another deer even bed anywhere near that. You just don't know. So that's why bedding areas provides a more consistent idea where the deer are bedding. One other thing, key point about that area, number 5, had a lot of deer sign in it. But I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that it's very close to the main, mm-hmm. the biggest feeding field on the property, to where the deer have to go through. It'd be like an alleyway in New York is next to a restaurant. Well, it's not a great area to hang out. It's just that there's a great restaurant right next to it.
Exactly.
And so this is just one of those areas that I think if you add more cover there with a thinning, a borderline clear cut in it, you're going to have great native forage. and bedding to where deer feel more comfortable there, to where they may even bed there. That may be one of the better bedding areas in that spot, to where they don't have very far to go to get to that food plot, to where you may see more daylight activity around that or in that field because they don't have as far to go. Plus, they already feel safer there because there's cover there. And we'll talk about how to even stack on top of that with even more cover around that food plot.
Mm-hmm. And so it's important to make that certain distinction. Deer sign present in one area doesn't mean that it's necessarily a productive area or that it can't be improved on. And so number five, that's number five, red pine thickets. We can improve on them. Number six.
Well, number five, we didn't talk about Scotch pine either. We were talking about evergreen, so we went from the hemlock to the red pine. Now, another thing that was present in that area was the Scotch pine, and you may see this in certain places of the country where there's a pine tree, and specifically the Scotch pine's not native to this area, and there's a couple pockets of it there, and we are recommending to remove all those. It's a non-native. We would rather have a hemlock tree, which is providing benefit to a lot of species, not just deer, but it's also got great cover, and it's not as invasive as the others. And so Scotch pine out, red pine good, hemlock good, Scotch pine not good. Matt, you don't watch Friends, you don't know that reference. That's what I was talking about. So anyway, number six,
this is a desert.
Yeah,
but from an aerial point of view, it looks like, hey, that's a timber tract, probably maybe some forage in there, maybe some good bedding in there. I like to hunt in there. No.
Six to me was everything I've ever seen about the North Woods.
Yeah.
Browse line, wide open timber. Once you get down on a deer's level, it's like they have eaten everything.
There were leaves, sticks, and logs. And that was it. And you could see, and then this is no joke, and I'm not exaggerating, you could see 150 yards cleanly, like just straight through from the top of the property all the way to kind of that next food plot line. And I mean,
the only thing to hide them was tree trunks.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah. I know that there's like videos where you see someone like hiding behind like a light pole or something, or trying to. I imagine the deer doing something like that in this area because it was so densely packed that everything, the only amount of light was the very tippy top. So every tree that was here, and there's way too many stems per acre, but all the trees there, they were going straight up. So it was basically like pencils all just lined up right together, nothing underneath of them, and you could see forever. But deer bedded in there. I can't remember. I don't think we saw deer get up from there, but he had made mention, like in the snow, when he's hunting later season, he can look through there, climb his stand, and he's just watching deer doing their thing as they're bedded down in there. He can see them from 80 yards away to 100 to 150 yards away from that stand. Then they'll just get up and kind of feed and make their way out to the food plots, or to the larger crop fields from there. But it was classified as sanctuary.
And that's why the deer were in there.
Correct. And that's the only reason that they were in there. However, again, yes, deer are in there. There's deer sign in there. It's a sanctuary, but it can still be and should be certainly improved and improved drastically.
Cut trees, thin trees.
Got to.
Everything TSI to get sunlight on the forest floor. And not only by putting sunlight on the forest floor. Sorry, I was trying to multitask and check my phone there. Not only sunlight on the forest floor, you're going to get new growth, early successional habitat, and you're also going to get young forest. And so you're getting great cover, great food, but also now you add that with the security that's already associated with that area, and you have a great bedding area.
Well, and that's the other thing. The species that were in there growing, a heck of a lot of maples, and the quality of forage and maple leaves, super, super good. And basically, they're way out of reach. All it has to do is just cut them, TSI. And not only are you bringing security and better cover, the forage value within that area, the carrying capacity of the property, is going to be increased just by bringing that resource back down to a level that the deer are going to be able to have access to. And that's another thing that, as we're talking about opening up the canopy, removing some of the pines, managing the timber, we need to have a lot more woody browse on the property, a lot more broadleafs on the property. We need more sunlight hitting the forest floor for additional forage, because there's browse lines through this timber. We saw a lot of places that had been clear cut in the past, I think 5 years ago or so?
Something like that.
But the regeneration was not all that exciting. It was very limited in these areas because of the amount of deer. So that's something else to take note. We need to increase the amount of forage around the property. And this is one of those areas that we can certainly do that. And that's within a sanctuary. So
it makes some more income for the owner.
Yeah. Yep.
Sell some logs, make some income. You can put that to a wife's new car, or you can put that in maybe some new diamond earrings, or back into the habitat. You make that decision.
You be the
judge. Number
seven. I ain't getting into that.
Number seven goes right into the difference between number six and what we're looking for. Number seven, there's two spots that we've located, and that's where these clear cuts have happened. Some of these clear cuts, to where these were some of the better looking clear cuts on the farm, where there's a lot more early successional type plants growing, as well as young forest.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a ton of browse on the young forest, ton of browse on the food plots, a lot of reports of a lot of deer, so we knew we needed more food. And one of the best ways we can do that is by replicating what happened in seven, but then keeping it in a beneficial stage by fire.
Yes.
And so they don't burn a lot. And of course, there's a very short window in Michigan on when you can, basically when the snow melts,
right,
when the ground's dry, and then before spring green up. And so there's a small window in there, but we're going to kind of section this off into where we have basically four big units, to where hopefully every year a portion of the farm can burn, and we know we have very beneficial species coming back within reach of the deer.
And that's the other portion of having that great road system that we talked about earlier. He's pretty much set up already for these burn units. And maintaining that road system that he does is super important, because, again, sometimes these fire windows are really short in areas like his. So he's going to need to be able to move fast. When he sees the right weather approaching a day, 2 days in advance, basically right now, the way his property is and the road condition, he's ready to drop a match. They're cleared off. They're well maintained. He can go. He can jump when he needs to jump, basically, and get that fire out there. But like you said, Adam, these were great locations, great insight to, okay, if we do open up the canopy, what's going to come back? And basically, what species can we expect to flourish? What species can we expect to get hammered by the deer? But it was a great indication that, hey, you know what, that habitat, you know, it is in place, and we can offer this clear cutting throughout the property in different areas. And again, these are going to be great bedding areas that he's going to be able to move in and around, hunt around very effectively. And I think he shared a story of himself killing, I think it was this year, a good buck, his second buck with a bow there. That had basically, he had seen it that morning, figured it had gone into one of these clear cuts, and hunted that vicinity the evening and killed it.
Yep.
I mean, it worked to a T, worked to a plan.
I think you brought up an interesting point for me with the fire, is the fact that, you know, in our research, and of course I've known this for a while, when you just look at a map of the U.S. and you look at different habitats and oak savannas, and there's a big portion of Michigan that has oak savanna, native oak savanna. So pre-settlement, there was these oak savannas stretching up through it, and it covered this area we're talking about, this region anyway. And that tells us, and then you kind of look at the landscape of what Illinois was, and the great prairies of Illinois, and that rolling kind of right into the southern part of Michigan, and it was a landscape shaped by fire and grazing. And who knows the last time that fire ran through these woods? And we know that that is part of the landscape, naturally speaking. So getting that back in there is only benefiting the land and the animals that live there.
No doubt. No doubt. And that's the other thing is, okay, this is the species that we see have come back with no fire, without fire, just naturally regenerated. But what happens when we do reintroduce fire? What else is going to come back that's been in that seed bed laying dormant? What else can we expect to see? We don't know, but it'll be interesting because what we see now in this habitat, in this area, this landscape, is not what it naturally was. So that will be interesting for him to see, but for us to follow along as well and continue to learn.
It's coming up, but we're not there yet because we still have one more point. Number 8,
mm-hmm.
The large X marks the spot field. When you look at it in an aerial image, it's got a big X
old
from,
X.
What do you say that was? Switchgrass that he put out through
I
there?
I believe so, yeah.
Don't tell me, though. Actually, yeah, that's what it is. Okay. Just making sure, because number 9 is a very interesting topic.
Yeah, wasn't number 9.
No,
yeah.
Number 8. So it's the large food plot, the largest food plot on this property. And, of course, there's scattered food plots around, but this is the biggest one.
I think he said it was 3 acres.
Okay.
3 acres in size.
It's a great reminder of there's a lot of deer in the neighborhood, and we are going to do our best to provide as much forage, native forage, and cover throughout the entire property. But these open fields, of course, as hunters, we like to see a lot of deer, and we like to improve our hunting success. So a food plot is a great thing we can do. So, but to take that one step further is we're going to improve the production of these food plots. We're going to try and, instead of just planting soybeans and letting them just be a soybean field, we're going to plant soybeans and then come back and plant a fall mix sometime in August, basically right before rain, and broadcast it. Or if the beans haven't been productive, we're going to drill right through it, and we're going to have great forage. Hopefully, ideal situation, we have standing beans with a whole mixed bag of fall greens growing up underneath that standing grain. So even if they eat all the beans, there's still a food source available below them. And so we're just trying to increase the amount of forage that we can produce in these open areas. So, and adding diversity to it is a huge part of the success.
No doubt.
That's going to come.
It's kind of like that 1-2 punch. It's basically, hey, I've got open ground. I've got light getting to the ground because my beans are getting hammered. They're getting overbrowsed. If I have that energy getting down there, how can I better utilize? And that is, like, just like you said, overseeding in certain areas or drilling through those beans and putting a cool season mixture. And we're talking a high diversity mixture, so it's going to offer a lot of different forages, be able to withstand some browse pressure, and you're going to have basically 2 forages, 1 plot, 1 location, and get you much further along. Because it was funny when he talked about all the other food plots scattered throughout. He had planted a mixture of turnips and brassicas in one of them, and he had great success, knee high. And then all of a sudden, boom, that light switch hit, and they turned on to him. And it was days, a couple of days, and
hammered them.
Gone. Like,
and then once they were gone, there was nothing.
Right. He had nothing to hunt over. And it would stink from his point of view. Hey, I've done all this work. I've put money into these food plots, whether it's inputs, additional seed, but I didn't even get to hunt over it. And the window of that high quality forage was so small. How much benefit did it do? Because there were just so many deer packed into these areas, and it didn't end up being a hunting location. So we need to help increase the amount of forage. We're doing that through clear cuts and woody browse, prescribed fire. But then right here in number 8, adding more food in one location besides just that monoculture soybeans from springtime all the way through to winter.
Well, when you think about it too, and he had those fenced off, so that was an area that the deer weren't even able to take advantage of during the growing season because they were fenced off. So that goes with the question of, if we plant something, when is the right time to open up the fence? Or is it appropriate to put the fence out there? And it's a great hunting strategy, but then again, it's a whole lot of area that is not providing any benefit to the wildlife during the growing season when it's fenced off. So adding multiple species, and instead of just planting one type of clover, it's a mix of clover and chicory and some of the grasses, such as wheat or oats, to add some other things to the table, to where hopefully our soil's always covered, but there's always something to eat.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing about the fence, like that whole 3 acres, those deer in the summer, the growing season, when those beans are really important and would offer an incredible forage opportunity, they don't even have access to them. Now, mm-hmm. it's necessary for him to do that, to have the additional forage for late season and the pod production. But my goodness, I want them to benefit the soybean like a soybean should be benefited.
Yeah.
And that's growing season forage as well as late season wintertime forage. So that's an important thing to note. Okay, how else can I get food throughout the property? And we're always reverting back to, okay, food plots are supplementing the native browse. Time to increase native browse. We talked about browse lines. We talked about seeing 200 plus yards through throughout the timber. So things are going to need to change in that timber, because again, it's 130 acres. We've got, I think it's 5-6 acres of food plots. So majority is timber. We've got to focus efforts there.
Now, when you look at number 8, we talked about food plots, but another way we're going to improve the production of the food plots, and more specifically, try to get deer in them more during the daylight hours, that's we're going to once again improve the edge.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be able to do some edge feathering in areas, and I don't know, we haven't really coined a phrase or anything, but open and closed edge feathering. So we're going to do some edge feathering that kind of helps steer some deer with closed type edge feathering, where trees are more parallel with the edge of the plot, where a couple of the trees are parallel with the plot, to where it creates kind of a natural fence. We're going to use that to try and help allow us to get in and out of stands in certain pockets. Then we're going to do more of the open type edge feathering, which is where trees are perpendicular with the edge of the plot, to where deer go through that very easily and they feel comfortable, because there's, once we allow more sunlight, because we've dropped some trees, there's going to be more early successional habitat, more young forest, so there's more forage, there's better cover. But then take that one step further, right out on the food plot. Now we're in food plot, we're in area number 8, we're going to plant our mixture of native grasses and wildflowers that we've put together for it. And that's the great thing about our little blends that we're putting together with Pure Air Natives, is we have it regionally specific. So we're not going to have some grass, let's say, that's more ideal, more suited for southern states. We're going to have more northern type grasses and forbs for these areas, to where we're going to make that another additional step in the staircase, to where deer feel more comfortable. There's better habitat. We're improving the amount of habitat for the small game species, going back to last week's podcast. So hopefully we have more field mice, rats, rabbits, to where predation, because they did talk about coyotes in the area, mm-hmm. To hopefully they're predating more on those and not focus so much on the deer, adding even more stress during the winter period. So hopefully that is going to help take that stress off, but also improve the amount of security that the deer have, to where maybe they get to the plot 30 minutes earlier than they have, just because they feel more comfortable there, because there's more steps in the staircase of edge habitat.
And another important part to notice and take in with that is, when we're talking about the open and closed edge feathering, is the hunting opportunities that you're gaining from that. Now you've got more sunlight there. A deer can't see all the way through the food plot. They have to get actually out in the food plot, which typically is going to offer a shot opportunity for someone to take, rather than a buck, you know, eyeing the food plot from 60 yards back in the timber and saying, oh, there's not a doe out there, I don't need to go all the way out there. And then it's going to put deer, it's going to create these pinch points, these funnels, these bottlenecks in and around the food plot that you can hunt, hopefully have shot opportunities with bows, close range. They just work really, really nicely, and a huge, I think, definitely more than a double-edged sword, the benefits of having that soft edge.
Yes, and when you look at that plot on Ariel, I don't know if it's going to show up on the map that we sent out there, but the X there was by design to try and break up that break up that field. And I've said this a lot of, if you have a large field, you have to break it up if you want deer to come out in it more during daylight, to where they have to search for that doe. They have to look for that receptive doe. They have to look for the sound of that grunt. And they can't just stand at the edge of the field and say, there is nothing out there. What? Who made that sound? That doesn't make me feel comfortable. So they may try and loop way around and get downwind to sniff it out before they ever even try to find it with their eyes. So breaking up those large fields by planting these strips of native grasses, adding the edge native grasses, and also doing edge feathering will allow you to maneuver around the field more without being seen, but also it's going to make the deer hunt and really look to see who's out there.
No doubt. No doubt. Lots of benefits with that.
Number nine.
Oh.
I don't even want to say it.
This, and number nine, and we put number nine here because it's closer to the edge. However, number nine honestly is spread throughout the entire property. I'm kind of surprised.
The reason I put it there was because that's kind of the hub. That's where it all started. You can see that's where the biggest infestation is, and it kind of trickles out through the rest of the property. Number nine, you can see where they tried to plant these to screen off around the main part of the house and the barn and protect that big field, but all they did was plant a terrible, 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 terrible species of the autumn olive.
And honestly, this was a perfect example of its spread, of its invasiveness throughout this property. The edges of fields where they had planted for some unknown reason, the autumn olive, it was taking over. And even some of like the areas like number seven, those clear cuts, a good distance away from the autumn olive that was planted. However, in those clear cuts, you were still seeing autumn olive, and not just sprigs, but large shrub bushes of autumn olive. It had been there. It had reseeded there. And this is a fight that honestly had to have a kind of that heart-to-heart, listen, man, and I got to give him props. He was already taking measures to eradicate autumn olive on the property. He had sweated. He had sunk his tractor. He had worked his tail off and still has got a long ways to go to get ahead of the autumn olive. But he's definitely on the right track. But we still were able to see, okay, if this is planted, this is the extreme invasiveness that this plant can cause and wreak havoc on. I still scratch my head thinking, why in the world did someone do that?
We do that a lot with some of the, and I hate to say it, but a lot of times it's these hunting strategies that we do these things.
I think it's the immediate results that we want to see.
Yes, it's a steroid shot. Boy, I don't really, I mean, I want to do this because in 2 years I'm going to have great hunting, or I'm going to make a great little pinch point or something like that. I don't know. Autumn olive, it's one of those things that it's like, man, what were we thinking?
We are impatient.
This goes with everything we stand for of, let's think about what our thumbprint is going to be. What is our legacy on the land? And whoever did it.
Old silverback leaf.
That's not a legacy I want.
No way. If the only legacy I want associated with autumn olive is getting it gone.
Yes.
Out of here.
I want to be the man that didn't bring it. I want to be the man that took it out.
Yeah. And I tip my hat to Jason because he's doing a daggone good job. And he's mad at him. I think any person who had the infestation that he has on his place and has worked like he has to get them gone and still has got the battle ahead of him, I think would be like, yeah, I'm mad at him. I'm just straight mad. I hate them.
I hate them so much.
A pain.
Oh, and not only that, they're bushy, they're thorny. They have a ton of berries, so even if you do kill the main mothership of all of the area, you still have probably some younger ones coming just because of a big seed bank, And that's why there's an importance of fire. We have a species that's not adapted to fire. So once you reintroduce it, you can help knock it back to where you're giving it that Matt's famous lines of the 1-2 punch.
Boom, bang, boom, boom, bang.
And I have you ever punched anybody?
That was like the that was two 1-2 punches.
Okay.
Yeah. Gotcha. That's what that was.
So
look out, Audemars.
We're going to give them the 1-2 punch of we're going to hit the main big ones with the we're basically going to knock back the seed bearers, and we're going to kill them with some herbicide. We're going to knock them out, but then we're going to prevent the future growth of them with fire and knock them back that way as well. So a lot of things we can do, but the biggest overall look at the autumn olive is it's got to get gone. So
quickly.
Anyway, number 10.
Well, there's two more species there.
Oh, gotcha, yeah.
We did see multiflora rose, of course, but then there was another one that we don't commonly see, but it was only in one location that we saw anyhow. It could have been throughout other areas, but it was Japanese barberry, which is an ornamental, obviously, from Japan, kind of thorny, kind of rosish colored. Anyhow, that one was definitely get gone. Don't want that spreading because it was close to an area that was going to have some sunlight and then getting to the forest floor. So we want to make sure in those areas that we know is going to have some sunlight that those invasives are cleared out, targeted, removed before that happens. So that's just another one to throw out there. If you don't know what it looks like, look it up. Be sure that you don't have it on your property. If you do, find out how to kill it. Number 10.
It's not really, we put it number in an area, but it's really over the entire property, and that's knock the deer population back to a sustainable level to where the habitat can actually support it. Right now, it's out of whack. And you know, we talked about it with those guys that night at the co-op meeting was Michigan has got the hunting heritage down.
Oh,
everybody's a hunter. They're just loving it, but with a lot of hunters and a lot of tradition comes a lot of the traditional mindset of, and this one specifically is, I don't want to shoot a doe because that's the mother to all the bucks. So where with that mindset, people aren't shooting does. So the herd increases and increases and increases to where you have a stressed out herd, more susceptible to disease and other things. But most importantly, it's hurting the habitat because it's eating the food plots, but it's also eating a lot of the young forest, the early successional habitat, causing a browse line through the timber, and it makes it really hard to manage. So overall, and you're not going to have as healthy a deer because they're all crowded. There's a lot more social stress involved with high deer populations. So we put number 10 in that area to harvest deer, specifically does in the areas that hopefully we can harvest does and not put a bunch of pressure on the mature deer that he's after.
To give you an idea of we're talking about how many does, buck to doe ratio, this and that, late season he sent me a picture and then talked about that picture and what he was seeing that during that time frame of antler bucks to does in this food plot that we labeled number 8, looking out his barn, took the picture, and we're talking 30 to 40 does and 2 to 3 antlered bucks that are visible. Now, again, that's not all the bucks in the area. Totally get that. However, that is skewed, and that is very skewed. And that's a lot of deer in a small confined area, and it needs to be managed. And we talk about the regeneration of these clear cuts. We need to consider that the deer are hitting them hard. We're not seeing the growth back that we'd like to see in that time frame because of the amount of browse. And we're seeing, again, like Adam said, those browse lines through the timber. Those are all signs that there's too many deer on the landscape. We need to bring that back down to a suitable level. Yes, we're going to increase the amount of forage available, but we also still, no matter what, have got to get the deer numbers in check and provide basically a healthier herd by improving that buck to doe ratio. That's going to do a lot for the deer. We talked about the social stress of it, but just the nutrition that those deer are going to have if there's less mouths out there per deer is going to drastically increase with the food plot techniques, with the clear cutting, with the prescribed fire. So we're going to have less individuals, better buck to doe ratios, but within those individuals, we're going to have heavier body weights, and we're going to have larger antlers, healthier fawns, and overall better habitat out of all of this. So, and I think we told them even before we went out to the property and walked, as they're talking about, you know, what they're seeing during hunting season, what the trail cameras are telling them, this point, point number 10, is super, super important. And I say this confidently, but if they were only to focus on reducing deer numbers, they would see within the habitat and within the quality of deer that they see, I think, an improvement. They wouldn't have to do anything to the habitat, period. Just shoot a bunch of deer, bring it back down to a level, and I think that they would see an impact for sure across the landscape. But doing all this, putting points 1 through 10, man, we're off to an incredible property, making a large, I guess, headway in the property. So,
in a nutshell, number one, two areas, we're improving access to the property. It doesn't matter if you're in Florida or North Dakota or Alaska or wherever it is you're trying to improve the land, access is a key to improving the successful hunts on your farm. And so by adding boundary roads in these specific areas is going to improve the success, but also help the habitat because we're providing fire breaks. Number two is an old blueberry patch that is now more early successional. It's a great cover. It's a limited resource in that area. So we're going to try and improve more of those throughout the landscape. Number three is kind of a look at the crop areas. And the natural patterns right now has deer leaving the property to go to surrounding crop fields to get more food. Hopefully we can change that with some of the habitat management we have and have more deer staying longer on the landowner's property. Number four goes to evergreens, specifically the hemlock tree, native to this area, not as invasive as your eastern red cedar, providing great thermal cover during the winter months, providing great forage for a lot of other species, but also not crowding out. So you have a lot of other young beneficial species growing in these areas where you have great browse even during the winter months. Number five is a pine plantation of red pine that is sickly. It's crowded. It's not healthy, so we're going to remove a big portion of that, leave a few more pockets of the red pine, break up, give it a little more fragmented landscape, a little more diversity. Number six was this big area that we are trying to open up the canopy, make some income for the landowner through a timber harvest, improve the cover and forage in that area, and put that on top of the security that's already there because it's a sanctuary, and make it a heck of a hunting spot. Number seven, two locations, but it's a great indicator of what we're looking for with early successional clear cut, and a lot of great forage during the summer months, but also winter browse. So a huge improvement on the property by having more of those. Number eight was the food plot, improving the production of it through diversity and also edge and adding edge feathering and just overall making it a great place on the farm. Number nine, invasive species control with autumn olive, multiflora rose, and Japanese barberry. Very important to control your invasives. We say this a lot, but a lot of times on your property, it's removing something to instead of just always trying to add to the property. Sometimes you can be more beneficial by removing it, and by removing the autumn olives specifically will really improve this property. Number 10, shoot does. Don't stop shooting does until you feel like you actually have habitat that can withstand the deer herd in that area. So a lot of stuff to do, but this property is well on its way to being a premier hunting destination in southern Michigan.
I think the other quick thing is the property size. This is a larger parcel in southwest Michigan.
Oh, for sure. 130 acres. Everybody else that we talk to, a lot of times we're hunting 20 to 40 acres.
Right. So this is going to be a great, great property down the road. But again, no matter the property size, habitat management needs to occur. So that's it. I'm good.
Would you rather own a You have one purchase you can make. Would you rather own an electric UTV or a gas-operated UTV?
Ooh. I'm going gasser because I got two legs that might be able to walk. And I know the gas-operated is going to be able to do more down the road. And haul more, do more work around the farm.
Now, I agree. I would go, if I only had one choice. Now, the ideal situation is I have both.
Yeah.
Gas for the work and during the summer months, and then I use the electric during the fall. But overall, I'd rather just have the gas operated.
Yeah.
Yeah,
would you
sure.
Would you rather plant an orchard or create a new clover kill plot on your family's farm?
Well, I would say, you know, if I'm planting an orchard, it's also going to be a clover plot underneath because they both benefit each other. So I'm going to go with C. I'm going to take both because, but for me right now at this stage of my life, I just had this conversation with you. I'd rather plant the orchard because that's one of the things my wife is really interested in and excited about on the farm. So planting the orchard is another way. She, if I said, hey, honey, let's go look at the clover plot, she wouldn't join me. If I said, hey, let's go to the orchard and get some peaches, she would join me. So I'm planting the orchard.
And then looking at the clover underneath the orchard?
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, that pretty well wraps it up. Land and Legacy Clan in Michigan. We're in the North Woods. And hopefully that gave you an idea how we would manage up there. And hopefully it helps you on your property in the North. Guys in the South, don't worry. We're thinking of you, and we'll be back next week with probably management. And, you know, that's the thing. Habitat management, like we preach, is pretty well, you can use most of it throughout the country. And it's all about finding the native habitat and the native landscape for your area and working to get back to it. So, anyway, hopefully you guys enjoyed it. We'll catch you next time.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Land and Legacy's Hunting and Habitat Management Podcast. If you like what you hear, check us out at landandlegacy.tv. You can submit a viewer question right there, and we're answering the podcast, or find us on Facebook and Instagram.
Feels pretty good knowing that from the beginning of time, God has called us to be a caretaker, gamekeeper, a manager of the land. So with that being said, don't you think we should do it all for the love of the land and the glory to God?